This is a Decentered podcast from Rob Watson. Conversations about community media. Look out for Decentered Media on Twitter and on iTunes, or go to decentered.co.uk. Hello, it is Tuesday the 26th of February, and this is the Decentered Media podcast. And again, we're at the Dot Media Centre, hosted by John Costa. And tonight we're joined by Amber Rondell and John Hawker. And we're going to talk about a documentary project that Amber is producing and working on. And we might probably talk a little bit about kind of some stuff to do with media democracy, which we kind of finished off talking about last week. But let's start the conversation really by it's 26th of February, and I'm sitting here in a t-shirt. John is sitting here in a short sleeve shirt,
sweltering,
and it's really warm. What's gone wrong? Are we enjoying this weather?
Global warming at last.
You notice he didn't say I was sitting here in speedos. You know what I mean? Which clearly is worrying Amber. So like, you're not going about that.
It's a really worrying image in my head now, John.
I think it's amazing, actually. I've been sitting here all day doing various things in the Dot Media Centre, watching people walk past. And I mean, you know, I've got a short sleeve t-shirt on under here, but to see people walking around in t-shirts and stuff is very, very odd, because it is technically still the winter, isn't it?
We're doing that very British thing of lapsing straight away into talking about the weather, because it's unusual, isn't it? I've lived in different parts of the world, and people often say to me, what is that British obsession about the weather? And I say, you have to come and live there for a year and you will be obsessed by the weather. And here we are. But yeah, it's beautifully warm, isn't it?
It is really nice.
But it's really odd, because it is, we have to pinch ourselves and remind ourselves it's February. You know, it is winter, and my thing that normally this time of year, I'm okay with the cold. It's just the dull clouds that I don't like. So it's really nice being bright, but it really disconcerts you because it's also warm. And it's kind of like, you know, you go on a mini break to Lisbon or somewhere like that, and you can get off the plane in March and you go, oh, it's really nice and warm, spring-like, and you really feel the difference. Whereas the UK, it takes until about, you know, 3 days in July before it does that normally. So to have this, but do you think people should be concerned? Is this like a warning shot that we really now need to start doing something about this? Or is this just like a kind of, yeah, it's really nice, we're quite happy with this here, but, you know, should we be concerned? Amber, this is your generation's mess to sort out.
Yeah, sure. I personally like the warm, so I hope it stays warm. But it is an odd time to be so warm. Especially as it was just so cold as well. I don't know how that happened quite so quickly, but...
Because you guys had snow here, what, a couple of weeks ago, did you?
We didn't have snow, no.
No.
Not in Leicester, but we had it in the UK.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Home for me is Guernsey, so I sit down there. You know, we're always 2 or 3 degrees warmer than you guys, and the weather's always a lot more clement down there. Mm. Come and visit. And it's always strange to sit and watch the weather on the Beeb and look at that map and see all these fronts blowing across England, and we're sat there, you know, reasonably mild conditions. And so, but I'm also reminded, I think 3 or 4 years ago, no, 2012, we had the big freeze in which it actually snowed in Guernsey, and it brings it to a complete stop straight away. We're just not equipped for it. The schools close, the government offices close, everybody just closes and stays at home.
Maybe it's the extremes that catch people out, rather than the fact that if it was to be like this for a sustained period of time over the summer, then you just think, oh, this is maybe a good precursor for the summer. We always talk about Indian summers, don't we, in September, and occasionally you'll get one, but someone will always bang on about it. It's the extremes. I think it's, if we were used to snow and then it always snowed, it wouldn't be so bad. And of course, when we were kids, that's exactly what it was always like, wasn't it? You know, in winters it was cold and it snowed, and in the summer it was always warm and it was hot. So I think it's the extremes that we get out of season that maybe raises the alarm more than anything
exactly
else.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, I've lived in places where you can easily define the seasons. You can see what's happening, and you know that, you know, October's coming, it's time to do this. March is coming. It's time to do that.
I remember my time in New Zealand. It was very. We were there sort of September to December, and you could see it change in the first sort of 2 or 3 weeks, and then it was their summer. Yeah. You know, it was spring, and then it was their summer. It was very, very strange. I mean, you're quite well travelled, John. You've already mentioned a few places and stuff. I mean, did you say South Africa as well?
I lived in South Africa for 6-7 years, something like that.
And what was that like weather-wise? Was that consistently warm? And did you ever get
In winter up in the high veld, Johannesburg, Pretoria, up there, the winter there, it was very, very cold at night. Wasn't very, very cold, but the houses were not built for the cold. They're built for the hot. And so everybody wraps up in blankets, goes to bed at 8 o'clock at night, puts on an extra jumper. There's and you've got one of those oil-filled radiators burning in the very expensive electricity. Mm-hmm. But it was predictable. It was still predictable. You knew that you would get these big, long, high pressures, bit like we've got now here, and during the day, middle of the day, you could actually sit out and sunbathe, but then it got really cold.
I've been very lucky to visit Sweden, where you had that sort of 24 hours of sunlight, so I kind of went at the right time of year. But I remember a good friend of mine from school, we were talking about being connected, and I'm sure we'll come onto that at some point in the podcast, but my mate Dave, he worked in Norway for an oil company, and he just said, like, to have 4 or 5 months of darkness was just completely alien to him. You know, it really kind of throws your body clock out, and, you know, is it time for bed? Is it time to get up? You know, what do you do? And it's very, very strange. Have you lived in any kind of weather extremes like that, Amber? Have you experienced
that? Not me,
that?
No.
Rob?
No, because I think the UK is kind of, to go back to John's point earlier, is like 5 weather systems all in the same day. You know, you can get up in the morning, it's bright and sunny, in the afternoon it's raining, and in the evening it's windy or whatever, and it's, you know, you can't predict, really. But it's when you go, you know, when I was in Ghana last summer, it was the idea that, it goes dark at 6 o'clock every single night, and there's no extended evenings. We've just reached the point in the year now, which I think this kind of hot weather, unseasonably hot weather, coincides with this start. We're starting to see the extended evenings and the lighter mornings.
Well, even to the point, this is week 5 of 6 for our podcast, and the first 1 or 2 weeks, it was dark outside. I mean, like pitch black, with people walking past. So even now, isn't it? It's quite strange.
Yeah.
5 weeks into it, to that still be daylight.
That is bright. Yeah. And that kind of, you know, that cheers me up, because I'm not one for the dark and the gloom. As soon as you get to spring, it's like you can breathe again and you can relax. But, you know, you've then got to make the most of it and take advantage of it, because come June, July, you know that it's clocking backwards again, if you like, and the shorter days are coming again, and you just have to adapt yourself. Yeah. But in other places, you know, it's interesting when you go to other places in the world, Cambodia or Thailand and places like that, and that kind of seasonal adjustment doesn't exist. It's just consistent through the day.
Because of the latitude.
Yeah, know. Closer to the equator. So
I think I remember that when I was in South Africa, in the peak summer, it would get dark at about 7 in the evening. In the middle of winter, it would get dark about 6 in the evening or something like that. There was no real difference. You and I were talking about that recently and what it does to mood, weren't we? In real life, I'm a psychotherapist, and people come to me and talk about seasonal affective disorder and how that the gloom of winter affects them. Very much brought to mind when you were talking about, you know, you were lucky to be in Sweden when you had
a whole long
24 hours of day. But I can't imagine what it must be like to go for 4 months and never really see the light of day.
I notice like a significant impact on my mood when it gets dark at like 4 o'clock, and, you know, that's the end of the day. You know, I want to eat my dinner then and go to bed, basically. So, yeah, I personally like...
And it doesn't help that we're a 24-hour society that is electronic devices and blue screens and, you know, always on. And, you kind of set your body clock by what's on the TV or what box sets you're watching on Netflix. And you don't really follow your natural rhythm. You're following an electronic rhythm, aren't you? Your media rhythm, rather than... And you try and sustain that throughout the year to some extent.
Yeah. And without getting boring and technical, to go to sleep, you need a thing called melatonin, which you produce naturally, and light stops you producing melatonin. In fact, if you look into it, there's a really interesting historical record of a bunch of people who in a particular type of a part of France a couple of hundred years ago used to almost entirely hibernate. They come winter, they would just take to their beds and stay in bed and get up. Very little movement, very little food or water. They would just basically hibernate throughout the
That's fascinating, the dark isn't it? Because the world that we live in now, the ability to be able to function comes from maybe having to work and earn money and stuff like that. Whereas if we had AI does what they say AI is going to do, so therefore, you know, unless it's very, very, very manual, what are people actually going to do with this additional free time? And I wonder if it will go, rather than sort of going down the gym and doing this and filling your time, we'll actually have to change the rhythm of our life, particularly if we're going to live longer as well. You know, if someone's going to, on average now, going to live to be, my partner's got a grandson, he's 3.5. You know, if he's going to live to be 100, you know, which, touch wood, barring accidents, he could do. Wonder if the pace of life that we have will start to adapt and we start taking into the account those things, like slowing down in the winter and being more active in the summer.
But do we want that? Or is it quality of life we want? I mean, I've got a few years on you. Do you want to live 100 years, 120 years?
If those are good years, you know.
Quality of life.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly that.
And is that not what medicine's done? Medicine's stretched life, but it hasn't necessarily stretched, the quality. I've watched my aunt die over a period of 6 years, and if it wasn't for medicine, she'd have died over a period of about 6 months. Sadly, those extra 5.5 years that she had were really not good quality, and she didn't want to be there. She didn't want to live. Mm. She just wanted to peacefully go. So I think there's some instances where,
well, we've not caught up with it, have we? No. We've not done the thinking about it, and we've not kind of invested in the kind of preparation for that, because it's always unevenly distributed. So, you know, kind of, you know, people look back at the 19th century and the average lifespan was about 40 years old, you know, the 17th, 18th, 19th century. But that wasn't a natural lifespan. It was due to the harsh conditions of industrial, you know, factory work and digging canals and things like that. And you know, as you said, barring accidents, people could naturally live 60, 70, 80 years old. But it was things like, you know, kind of if you were lucky enough not to need medical treatment or your teeth were fine, that kind of thing. So it's kind of almost, if you like, the imposition of modern life has changed our perception of what our expectations are about what the quality of our lives and the duration of our lives. Whereas if we just kind of leave it to unfold in a fairly benign kind of environment, then it probably is quite well sustainable. As long as there's no predators or accidents or natural disasters or, you know, and it's kind of like I suppose it's the flow, but we live in a, you know, the modern world is cities and industrialization and technology, and that shapes the nature of our lives and our experiences as much as anything else. And are we equipped to adapt to and think about those things and absorb those things?
I think unfortunately, it looks as though from the outside looking in that we might be we might have evolved and adapted up to now, but I'm not sure. We are in the midst of an anxiety epidemic. You know, if you look at it, there's about 13% of the adult population of the UK who live on antidepressants, and we have to ask ourselves why. You know, depression isn't caused by a chemical imbalance in the brain. It's caused by having too much REM sleep, which is a reflection of how aroused you got the previous day. Well, why are we aroused, and why can't we do anything about that arousal? Why are there huge levels of frustration? And Amber, you know, you and I have had many discussions about mental health and how you get and keep good mental health. And I think right now, with the speed of change and in the context of what we're talking about, longevity, I think we've got a way to go before we actually evolve enough to be able to cope with the extra years that we've got. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Well, I think it's interesting because you're saying about evolving, whereas in fact we're not evolving. What we're doing is we're kind of hanging on to a smartphone and almost trying to fit the smartphone's ability rather than the smartphone has been developed to enhance us. So again, I think I quite agree with you.
Actually, especially
the brain. I think, yeah, electronic cocaine, I like that.
Yeah.
Particularly the brain and its ability to be able to function and handle those kind of... I mean, it must be rewiring. I mean, it must be giving everyone RSI. You know what I mean? So, you know, in 20 years' time, it would be, did you get RSI from working in an office, which it would have been maybe 10, 15 years ago or now, whereas in 20 years' time... I mean, my boys, they're 19 and 20, and to hear them, their necks and, you know, fingers and shoulders, and obviously from being hunched over... you just think it must be changing human the physiology of people, but also rewiring the brain. Surely, it must be happening. In
neural pathways. Yeah, I mean, you're not born with a predestined set of neural pathways that are going to open. It's what you physically do.
So it's what you're opening and connecting and forcing.
If you want to keep new neural pathways opening, you need to learn new things which involve physical movement. Sitting doing puzzles won't do it. But if you've never danced and you know, go and learn to do ballroom dancing or salsa or something like that, or take apart a car engine and put it together again if you've never done it before, or take apart an old-fashioned watch and put it back together again and things like that. Mm-hmm. Learn something new that involves physical movement, not necessarily fine motor skills, but...
I think that's what makes this some of this stuff here as well. When you get primary school children in and you get them putting the slides into the projector and turning it on and things like that, it really gets them something about that sort of sound as well. I think it's something completely new. And of course, the irony of it is, once they've done that, they can then download an app where they can film things like 8mm films, and it gives you the noise as well.
But it's also that again, Amber, you and I had the discussion, didn't you? Amber's a musician, plays trumpet, guitar,
and a little bit of piano. Yeah,
nauseatingly talented people.
Make documentary films. Good grief!
Yeah, and listening to live music. You know, just actually going and listening to live music. There's the, you know, as a finger slides up the guitar string, or the bow as it moves across the string of the cello or whatever it is. For you, you don't take that for granted. But there are, you know, an MP3 is a compressed file that has had so much taken out of it just to be able to fit it into our whatever.
Yeah, I mean, it's a totally different feeling, isn't it, when you're kind of sat and there's an orchestra and you can like feel the music. That's an inspiring
when you can
thing,
feel it. Yeah, it's very different, isn't it?
Yeah,
I suppose that's where your purists really go back to vinyl. We had a guy, a friend of ours, Steve Beverly, last week, whose house is literally full of vinyl. I mean, you've got to step round it. I mean, he's a real aficionado, and we'll go out and almost have like clucking withdrawal symptoms if he went into a record fair and couldn't buy something or find something that he wanted. And when you listen to him talk about vinyl and his love of music and jazz, and we started a jazz show which he then took on, and we had a jazz club up the road at the Cookie which he was involved in as well. And it's just that ability to get involved in something, because we were talking about hobbies as well. You know, no one has hobbies anymore. Everyone's too busy. You know, you're so busy filling your time with social media, which is actually my hobby, is going on social media and capturing the fact that I'm creating things for social media to tell you the fact that I'm really busy. And you go, well, but what did you do with your time? You know, did you actually take the time? And I suppose that dismantling of something, isn't it?
It is. I got into a terrible argument, unfortunately, with somebody recently who told me she was a feminist. And, you know, I found absolutely fantastic. What do you do to be a feminist? And she didn't understand the question. You know, it's, well, no, what is it you do? You know, yeah. Emily Pankhurst went and organised a lot of women to, you know, make sure that you guys got the vote. You know, people threw themselves under racehorses to you know, demonstrate their feminism. Germaine Greer, you know, organised a bunch of people to burn their bras and go and do demonstrations. But what do you do? Well, unfortunately, the answer was that she sits at home and tweets her outrage.
Calls me a misogynist, sexist pig on social media, which I got called last week. So
I knew we'd be able to bring Rob in here on the social media angle.
I'd take that as a compliment.
Well, in the context, it was all right. And the interesting thing is, I mean, there's a woman used to write in the 80s, Nell Noddings, who And I think it's really pertinent for today in terms of people having something that, and we've talked about this before, something that people care about. You know, I care about feminism, I care about the environment, I care about, you know, kind of destitution on the streets. No, but what you care for is a different question. And it comes from the position of then saying, well, when do you go out and volunteer at an animal sanctuary or protest against, you know, misogyny in politics, or you go out and protest, you know, you do something for helping people.
What do you do?
And it's that, and we live in a society which is very much, you know, that kind of consumer-driven society, which is kind of, things are kind of readily, we've talked about it before, the kind of ready meal culture, and things are ready, just laid out for you. And there's almost a sense, you know, there's that phrase that goes around at the moment, which is about frictionless trade, when it's kind of frictionless life. Expecting life to be frictionless is a myth, because actually it's to learn, you have to overcome those challenges and those frictions, and that you lay things out. One of the things about picking up on that neural kind of pathway thing, I wonder if actually we think about this the wrong way around, and that the neural pathways are what allow technologies, that we're just using what we've got, if you like. We wouldn't adopt these new technologies if we weren't already capable of adopting them. If they were hard for us to adopt, we wouldn't adopt them. You see what I mean? You're kind of flipping it around the other way and saying the reason that these things are popular is because we are good at it. And these are the things that we're good at, and it can spread around the population.
I get what you're saying.
I'll put the kettle on, Amber. We'll sit back and watch this one. I reckon this is going to go. Something. Got a bit of mileage
to me,
in it, this
one. The analogy... Okay, well, we're really good at drinking beer. You know, that's so... Well, isn't that a good thing that we've already got the neural pathways that are capable of absorbing beer and using it to our advantage?
Well, I mean, to an extent, but then you reach a tipping point of self-destruction, don't you? Because, yeah, you're good at it, but doesn't mean to say your critical faculties kick in at some point and say just because you can doesn't mean to say you should. But we are good at, you know, that high that comes from, you know, British culture, particularly British culture compared to most European cultures, doesn't use alcohol in the same way. There's something about our cultural setup that says that the way to get through life and to be popular and extrovert and out there, and you're talking about the anxiety kind of epidemic, if you like, is to show that level of kind of alcohol-fueled interaction with other people. And once you ask people to step back from that and think about who they are without their dependencies, and I'm sure you deal with a lot of people who have those kind of, you know, kind of, and we all do at some point in our lives, I think, in one form or another. You know, once you step back from that and you're thinking about what it is you have to do for yourself, your own framework of understanding the world and yourself without dependencies on alcohol or electronic devices, that's a whole other challenge, and we're not geared up for dealing with that in many ways.
I agree with you, but my way of looking at it is that what we're all trying to do all the time is to make ourselves feel good. We were all born with a need to make ourselves feel good, and you can take a shortcut to doing that. You can snort cocaine up your nose and you'll feel great, but the price you pay for that will be too high. And the, generally speaking, if you look at it, if you grade things by how much effort you have to put in to feel good, the more effort that you have to put in, the more sustainable they are. If you don't have to put any effort in, then that eventually the pain will exceed the gain. The price that you pay will be much too high for the pleasure that you got. And if you look at the different things and apply that as a rule of thumb as to whether it's electronic cocaine that we were talking about, or whether it's real cocaine or alcohol or whatever we're doing, and To me, one of the most important things you can ever do to find fulfillment is to be able to sit quietly in a room on your own with your own thoughts and feel comfortable in your own skin and do it for, you know, a period of time. I don't mean several days, but I mean an hour. And most of my millennial friends, he said, turning, looking at Amber, would be incapable of doing that for more than about 60 seconds because they reach out for the electronic cocaine and just need, you know, that need that bit of the brain stimulated, please. And I think, to me, it's how much effort do I have to put into this? If I don't have to put much effort in, there's a price I'm going to pay for this eventually.
Amber, as a third-year student at university, picking up on what both Rob and John were saying. Do you feel that, I'm not going to talk to you about drug use, obviously, so, so I'm not asking for a confession. It was more a case of, do you feel that the pressure to be a student, as in live the student lifestyle, has changed for you from the first year through the second year into the third year now?
Great question.
Thanks.
There's a lot to say about this. Well, first year, definitely.
And we'll start at Freshers Week.
Yeah, that student culture is the only way to fit in. That's what I felt. It's the only way for me to make friends, because you're all alone. Everyone's all alone, though. And so I did try it, you know, try to fit in with the student world. But I did find after a few months, it wasn't for me. And you could still, for instance, I mean, alcohol, I don't really drink. I did at the start, but I realised quickly that I don't enjoy drinking. But actually me going to a party with some of my friends and saying, yeah, I'm not going to drink, I'm just going to have a good time about it, I got a lot of respect for that, and a lot of
people...
It also
takes a lot of confidence to do that,
yeah,
I think,
and
as
a
well.
Lot of people were like, oh, wow, she can enjoy herself without getting drunk. Like, oh, that's, you know... And so that's what I kind of started to do, and I was really happy with that.
I think it's... Sorry, Rob, Nicole.
No, I was going to say, are there more... Because that's the complete opposite of my experience when I was your age, which is... You know, I come from Liverpool, you learn to go to the pub, everything's about boozing, you know, I've kind of learnt from that these days, I hope. And that whole kind of to get over my kind of, not shyness, but kind of, you know, I think we're both introverts and that kind of sense of, so I used to have to use alcohol to just be able to stand somewhere and kind of hopefully interact with people, because I couldn't do it. I'm terrified of people in many respects.
Yeah.
And they depended on the circumstances. Now I understand that, and I've kind of I've been able to get some perspective on it. But the role models, and particularly the role models and the kind of framework that's thrown at students, is popularity, excess, you know, kind of the exuberance, all those extroverted things. And it's kind of, hang on a minute, you know, kind of, some of us just, but there's a lot more people now who are coming into this country who don't come from societies that are so dominated by that kind of mindset.
Yeah, I agree. And I think what you're saying about, you know, being kind of that more shy person, introvert, I recognised very quickly alcohol was great for me to become, you know, exuberant and exciting, and like I would become who I wanted to be. And I saw that and I went, you know, there's a pattern that will emerge and I don't want to become dependent. And so that's kind of what triggered me to go, no, I'm going to stop and I'm just going to try and be myself without it. And a lot of confidence came from doing that.
Is that easier to do now that you're in the third year? And was it easier to do in the second year than it was in the first year?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, again, after then not drinking and then doing the parties and the clubs and whatever, I realised again, I don't like that. And I'd rather go for a nice meal with my friends or something. And I guess a lot of that, I'm actually autistic, I have Asperger's. And so I think a lot of that is because of that. But yeah, third year is a lot easier just to be yourself and chilled and relaxed.
But do you still come under pressure? Is there a social pressure? Oh, why aren't you coming out drinking with us? Is that...
Yeah, to a certain degree, but it's who you spend your time with, really.
So I'm saying, is that your friendship circle, or is that from people outside your friendship circle who think that you should be doing that?
A bit of both, yeah.
I mean, one thing that's definitely changed in recent years is the number of restaurants and cafes that you've now got in city centres, whereas before it always used to be, you know, it was alien. You know, 20 years ago, it was, you know, kind of pubs and clubs and things like that. So you kind of, the context has changed in some... to some extent. You've got other alternative options, maybe not great options, but at least some options to do things in a different way.
So just to pick up on that very much, is that not the key to it? Is it's the hand of commercialism that reaches into our lives, and it does in so many ways, that drives the anxiety epidemic that I referred to, but it's the hand of commercialism that drives alcohol consumption. They are an enormously powerful lobby. If booze was banned in the UK tomorrow, the tax revenue that would disappear runs into I don't know how many billions, and so there is always a government is always treading that line, isn't it, between imposing rules on us, interfering in our lives, taxing our pleasures and our indulgences to continually feed the machine, which you know,
one of the phrases that I think we'll come to live to regret and kind of look back on as a kind of a kind of emblematic phrase of how bad things have become is in moderation. Because what does that mean? You know, people talk about their diet. You know, you can eat what you want in moderation. It's like, well, how do you define
one donut, not all six?
How do you define
or 12
or every day? You know, and it's kind of how do you define what moderation is?
My father's favourite joke, he'd stand there with a gin and tonic in his hand and say, everything in moderation, including moderation, cheers, you know. I can remember that very, very well.
Yeah, it's you know, the doctors used to prescribe cigarettes for anxiety, you know, kind of have a packet, you know, just don't go mad, you know. And it's kind of, well, what does that mean? And if all you can buy and the only things that are available to you, the only choices and options you've got, I said, there was a conversation I had with a friend a few months ago, and she kind of really encapsulated this well for me. Was, you know, people can't really change that easily, you know, but you can change the environment in which people have choices. So the classic advice for, you know, an alcoholic, stop going to the social alcoholic, stop going to the pub. You have to change your habits and where you go and what you do, and we have to change the environment.
I think that's what makes it really interesting here in Leicester, isn't it? Because we have such a diverse, multicultural makeup as well, that has people of religion that don't drink. So I remember when I ran Citizens Eye, you know, whenever you were going to do some sort of community-focused journalism event or talk or, you know, guest lecture or do a film screening, you had to suddenly think about who your target audience was or who you could likely attract, to that suddenly realise that, you know, some people weren't comfortable in a venue that served alcohol, even if it was covered up. I mean, we've done that before as well. So it really makes you think about that. And I think also you've got this rise in coffee shops and, you know, like gelato places as well in various, you know, areas of Leicester, which is driven by young people wanting to socialise, stroke date, in an environment where they can't drink. So I suppose also, I think we spoke, I spoke to some of the students a couple of weeks ago about museums are seen as places for first dates. Two out of the six students in the third year that I was talking to on the social media practice module, one of them took their girlfriend, both of them took their girlfriends to the museum on their first dates. And one of them still regularly goes because it's something to do that's not only cheap but doesn't have to involve alcohol and stuff. And I thought that was really, out of the six students, two of them actually did that. And I think that's what it's about now. It's about going out and being social. And I suppose we could have this whole entire conversation, you know, particularly as three of us are old farts. And, you know, 130 years ago, all of us would have been dead and you'd have been doing this on your own because we'd have all been gone at 48. I'm sure we're all the other side of 50. Talking about having places to go for conversations and loudness of music, you know what I mean? Sort of, you know, places that play, you know, even sometimes you go in coffee shops and it's quite loud and, you know, that kind of thing. I think it's really interesting, you know what I mean, having a conversation.
Yes. You've really struck on it. As Amber said, Amber's got Asperger's syndrome. One of the things that is very prominent in her and is in most people with Asperger's is a sensory thing that goes on, a real sensitivity to lights, sound, and so on. These lights will probably be driving you absolutely mad. But where were we the other night? Perhaps we shouldn't mention the chain of restaurants that we went into. It was just a cacophony. Neither of us could hear ourselves think. There was a physical pain to you in that, wasn't there? That you had to get out of there.
I had to get out, and yeah.
I was in with my friend the other night, the Dover Castle, which is a gay bar in Leicester, and there was kind of it was quiet, and we were having a nice conversation. The music was a bit loud, but it was kind of for my taste. But it's kind of we were sitting there, and then a few people came in, and the kind of DJ came in with a box or whatever it was, and I said, "The music's going to go up now." And just as I said it, the music went up, and my friend was pissing himself laughing because it was just that thing of
you're in control of the volume.
Yeah, you know, it's like and you know, it's like you can predict it. And, you know, it's kind of it, and we said, you know, actually the place is half empty. They're not what they used to be years ago, and you would be better off. You go to, I mean, I don't like Wetherspoons for various reasons, but they don't have music playing.
So you moderate the music.
It's amazing how popular they are without having music there.
Do they not? I'm entirely delighted to hear that. I shall populate Wetherspoons in the future. There's a whole movement. I forget what it's called. You go online.
Yeah, and Marks and Spencer's doesn't play music in their stores anymore.
I know Marks doesn't. Yeah,
Morrison's, I think,
Waitrose
stopped playing
it. Yeah. Here at the, and you saw my partner Tina come in. She's the community manager here at the High Cross. So they took part in 2 autism hours. Yeah, and then they decided to actually implement it every Saturday for an hour, 9 till 10. Here, the whole shopping centre has no music, and every single retail store. And the first person that spoke to us about it was Rupal Rajani from BBC Radio Leicester, radio presenter, who has balance issues, and she said now she can actually shop.
Yep.
In the High Cross at that time. And hers is balance, nothing to do with like, you know.
The sad thing is that there is 1 minute in a day when High Cross or anybody else feels that they need to play music to get us into some kind of mood to spend more money. I remember years and years ago when this first came in, it was actually British Rail, as it was then called, and they brought it in Waterloo Station. And at 9 o'clock or 8 o'clock in the morning, or whenever it was that all the commuters were coming into Waterloo, they had marching music to get everybody revved up to march into their office.
I love that story.
Sing the company song, and then yeah. And then at the end of the day, they had soothing, calming, you know, Mantovani as everybody
to see you
on
home
the, on
for
the
journey home.
5:15 to Woking.
And now everybody's working with their iPods in and listening to their own soundtrack, and kind of, you know, that's constantly with you.
Or listening to iPods, listening to podcasts, we hope.
Well, we hope, yeah.
Particularly this one, which is a high quality
yeah,
one. Now, Amber, thank you for coming in and also bringing John with you, because there's a specific reason that we've asked you to come in today. Now, I did a talk to you a couple of weeks ago about documentary, and this being the Documentary Media Centre, and someone had already mentioned to me that you made this 3-minute documentary where you interviewed John about his experiences. So maybe you can just give us a bit of an overview of what it is.
Yeah, so it must have been in November now. It was John's first time going back to New York in 17 years. Since the 9/11 attacks, he used to live there, and he was right at the bottom of it as it collapsed. So I kind of wanted to film him retracing his steps, and see what that experience is.
So you actually made the film there as well?
Yeah, we did a bit of filming there, and then I interviewed him afterwards. So.
Okay. For what was the before we speak to John about that fateful day and any reflections that he chooses to share, will be completely down to you. There's no pressure to say anything at all. And hopefully we'll screen the documentary in November so people can come and watch
please.
It at the Dot Media Festival. Yeah. For you as a filmmaker, but obviously someone that knows John, what was it like for you, that experience? Because obviously you'd been aware of the stories, but here you're kind of specifically talking about it for a reason that's going to be captured. You know, as a filmmaker, that's
quite
a big thing.
It's kind of like you hear about an army going to war, and you're like, oh, you know, something bad happened and it's a tragic event, and you kind of understand that, but it's not until you hear a soldier's you know, actual events, what happened to him personally, that it really hits home.
So you've got that level of detachment when it's news, maybe, or you're watching someone else's documentary, but suddenly
you were
actually in the moment with that person telling the story.
Yeah, you know? It came very real, because I was very young when it actually happened. And so hearing John's story and how it really, I think, almost traumatised you, I'd say, for quite a few years afterwards, that really hit home for me.
Now, what I always try and do here with the Documentary Media Centre is about that, you know, how you can use documentary, film, photography, audio, new media to come together to help those real places, real people and real events, well-pedalled things that I talk about. But for me, it's very much around you only move from awareness to action around some of these global issues is when you understand stuff. And so for me, things like, you know, personal stories, that connection, especially as a journalist, I'm really interested in those things. That's how you get a real connection to it. So as someone that was quite young, when it happened, and obviously wouldn't have been on your radar at all, probably. Has that changed your relationship with that event? If we were going to have a conversation there, do you feel more able to, obviously not, you could share John's story, but do you understand it more? Do you feel like you've got an understanding of it now because of...
Well, definitely. And I think, well, there is more of an emotional connection there with that story. And yeah, I mean, I guess I feel like I've lived it through John, really. Yeah.
I mean, because an hour's testimony that was filmed that you gave, I mean, that's a long time, John. We'll come on to you to actually put yourself in that situation, because for that hour, you know, you're feeling it, aren't you, really?
Yeah. it's an odd one. I don't, as I said earlier, in real life these days, I'm a psychotherapist, and if I've got a special area, it is trauma. People have been traumatized. I do a lot of work with an ex services veterans charity, PTSD resolution, and I understand what trauma is, and I don't think I was actually suffering from post-traumatic stress with regard to that. It certainly wasn't a nice day. I think there are several things that helped me. I think the bit that which you managed to drag some tears out of me in your documentary was that it's the first time I've ever said that I did nearly die, and I reflecting on it, I did on a number of occasions, and I think of it as my, you know, my, if you've watched Indiana Jones films, the bits where, you know, the bricks are dropping an inch in front of his face and an inch behind his head, and it was like that as I was running. But
and you think that sort of another day, another place and another time, then one of those would have hit you and that'd have been it, and you'd have been one of the statistics, isn't it?
Yeah. I was very fortunate. I was very lucky. You know, good fortune is a wonderful thing. There's so much I don't know about it, and I haven't really thought about it. And I think, to me, there's enough amusing moments in there as well, which I can relate to.
I'll put that down to your British sense of humour, maybe.
It definitely wasn't very much appreciated by Americans. I think I was helped a lot by the Americans. You know, when they were being interviewed, but for TV, they'd be... Yeah, it was terrible. I did this and this happened. It was carnage, and they pointed a camera at me. This was a few weeks afterwards, and said, "And what was it like for you?" And I said, "Yes, it was quite a challenging day, really."
I think it's that kind of typical British understatement about, like, you know, well, it kind of happened, and I came out the other side. Many didn't, type thing. You know?
I was one of the lucky ones. I managed to help some people that day, which again I think was, you know, a useful thing. I don't think that if you'd put me in front of one of my colleagues, they'd have said you were traumatized by it, but it definitely affects me, and it did affect me, you know, with Amber. We conspired to be in New York at the same time for a day and a half. And
well, I think there's that retelling a story, that you can retell a story because people know, or it comes up in conversation. Yeah. Where, you know, we were talking about, you know, where were you the day Elvis died, or Lady Diana, and where were you JFK, and then where were you 9/11? So there's that kind of the regular, sanitized is not the word, but there's that way of telling the story where it's you just telling the fact that you were there. Then there's actually someone saying to you, you know, now tell me what it was, or tell me what happened and what it was like. So that's a real invitation to dip into a different part of the story that you don't normally share. I think, and also having read lots of things and spoke to lots of people and done lots of documentary screenings and stuff, particularly with survivors of things like genocide and that kind of stuff, you get used to the fact that there's the narrative that you know, and then there's the narrative of those that survived, and all of those are all about stories of near misses, and on another day, at another time, in another place, you wouldn't have made it. You know,
we all have that different perspective on things, don't we? Over the years, I've tend to have avoided the whole business of reliving it every year.
Remembrance
on when it comes on TV, I just make myself scarce. Not that it's traumatizing to watch it. Sure, it was a bad day. Let's all move on. You know, there were 300,000 people that died in a tsunami on Boxing Day and whatever year it was in the Indian Ocean.
2004.
Thank you. I don't hear much about. I don't hear quite so much about that for some odd reason. But what you know, America would depict as the seat of civilization, as New York was hit by some extremists, some misguided fools, call them whatever you like. There's that need to relive it every year. Is that effrontery? For me, it was just a very personal thing. It had. You know, I know that I was able to manage to help some people that day, and you know, perhaps.
Do you think it's that not only the experience of going through that, but the fact that you were able to help people is your way of dealing with it? Because one of the things I was going to ask you was about survivor's guilt. You have a lot of these things with like events like that. So you have a lot of people that feel guilty that they survived, and I suppose that's a very kind of, you probably come at some of that with some of your PTSD work with servicemen. Whereas this is more a case of you're able to process and deal with it based on the fact that you were able to help people that if you weren't there, maybe they wouldn't have made it. So that's a very different aspect of it.
I think there are some certainly who wouldn't make it. There's a very, very funny moment when I ran into a building, it's the World Financial Center, which is diagonally opposite, and there was a huge lobby in there. There was about 300 or 400 people in there who had, you know, I was one of those people, you know, by then I was covered in dust. The first building had fallen down. And this poor young policeman, clearly suffering from shock, came in with one of those giant electric megaphone things and told us all to follow him and head north. And I thought,
that's a very John Wayne thing to do.
The north building was the first one that was hit. The south building was the second one that was hit. The south building has just fallen down. I think the north building is going to fall down. So I leapt up on the desk, grabbed this thing off this poor policeman, said, he's talking rubbish, don't follow him, follow me. And it was like the Pied Piper, and we all went south, about 300. And I looked back, you know, in this dust and could see all these people. And we got down to by the side of the Hudson River there, and there were all these people following me. And I thought, oh, gosh, you know, suddenly the responsibility hits you. And there was a lovely, a really nice Asian couple who just in the panic just leapt into the river. And as soon as they hit the cold water, thought better of it, and they swam back, and we helped them out, you know, and carried on. And there's lots of really funny, strange, and odd moments like that in it.
Because
that
a lot of
a lot
of those things, when you look at any of these sort of extreme survival scenarios, I guess when you look at it, it's the fact that you can't prepare for it. It's not a normal day, and it's so far off of most people's. You know, I'm not being funny, but you know, if you've been in you've been in goal and someone's kicked a ball at you and it's really hurt you, if it happens again, it's one of those things that they're in that band of things that can happen to you. You know, if it happens again, it's probably going to hurt. But it is these, you're talking about extreme scenarios.
Yeah.
And then Rob wants to say.
You relate it to, at the time watching the news reports, a lot of people related it, oh, it's like being in a disaster movie. You know, that way you had to relate it in the framework of something else that you'd seen that allowed you to make sense of it. It was like being in something else.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's kind of, you know, an Indiana Jones movie. It was like being in that, because that gives you that kind of ability to say, you know, that overcome that stoicism, you know, and kind of then express it in something which is not you, but it's something else that other people can relate
That's
to.
That's a classic way of detaching yourself from something, which is a way of overcoming post-traumatic stress. When Amber was interviewing me, and I did get very, very emotional about it once or twice, didn't I? And we actually retraced literally my footsteps, the buildings that we walked into and out of, and that whole thing. But I think, I mean, and afterwards, I don't know if you're going to re-edit that movie into a longer version, but the funny thing about the whole thing, and in a way I have to laugh about it, when I was forced out of my apartment in Battery Park City, evacuated by a tugboat across the other side of the river, given a piece of paper telling me that the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, will take care of me, and terrific, just go and find somewhere to stay, a hotel. I didn't have any clothes or anything. I was still in my running shorts and trainers, and And there's a this whole adventure of a couple of hours walking, and then finding a taxi and a hotel and staying there, and then moving back into Manhattan into a hotel. And every day you would call this 0800 number, and they were going to tell you when you get back into your apartment. And every day they would just say, keep all the receipts, don't worry, you know. And by then, 6-7 weeks later, I'm allowed to move back into my apartment. I have to pay about $1,500 to get it industrially cleaned, but don't worry, keep the receipts. And you're given another piece of paper with an 0800 number on the next morning. I dial this 0800 number to make my claim, which by then was $15,862. I have that amount of money imprinted in my head.
I think there's a reason coming up why you know that number.
Well, this very nice lady on the other end of the line read me the standard screed off a computer that said, you know, you mustn't tell lies, it'll be an offence, all the rest of it. She said, it doesn't sound as though you're a US citizen. Are you American? I said, no. She said, I'm very sorry, we're only able to help US citizens. So the hint for your listeners, if ever you're in the United States
and
you are struck by a natural disaster, FEMA will not take care of you unless you have an American passport. I'm still $15,862 out of pocket.
The thing that strikes me with that is kind of like we tell these things on the basis of, kind of, you know, the hero's journey, and you were describing it like an adventure. You know, you overcome all these obstacles and you're interacting with all these people. But fundamentally what it was not a hero's journey, but a bureaucratic exercise and kind of you just passed from pillar to post, and that kind of, it's almost Kafkaesque in that sense.
Absolutely, it became Kafkaesque.
And does it help to resolve these kind of things by telling yourself this kind of hero story, or is that part of the problem? Are we too fixated on this idea that as a survivor, and you've been through something? Because this kind of phrase hero gets bandished around everywhere. Oh, you know, kind of every the survivors, and, you know, thank you for your service and all that kind of stuff. Has that added to our lack of ability to resolve these things, or is that something which is kind of a, you know, I suppose a natural way for people to try and explain things that they've been through, traumatic, problematic things that they've been through, but it doesn't really help in the long run?
There's many questions in that question. What is it that really helps people get past a trauma, and what actually hinders them getting past a trauma? And very often, just keep telling the story can make it worse, because what you're doing is reliving it all the time. That's one of the things you don't do with people who've been traumatized. You get these critical incident plans. You know, everyone's got a critical incident, and if something goes wrong, you need to sit down and get somebody to tell you what just happened. And invariably, that's not helpful, and it makes it worse. For me, I definitely wasn't a hero on that day, but did my actions save some lives? Yes. Absolutely, without, you know, I'm not a hero. I did what anybody else in my position would have done. I managed, for whatever reason, not to be hysterical and run around as some people were doing. What is it that makes somebody be able to keep their head in a difficult crisis situation like that? I have absolutely no idea. I don't have any sense of injustice that the American government owes me $15,862. I just have to be very stoic about it and laugh. I'm lucky enough to be in a position to where, you know, it didn't break me financially. Oh, yeah, if somebody gave me a check for it now, I'd say thank you very much and put it to some good use. But it's one of a number of funny moments in the whole thing, and you know, you did manage to drag some of those out of me, didn't you, when you were interviewing me about the whole thing.
But can I ask, how do you feel about everything now that it's been a couple of months since you were in New York and retraced your steps and told me your whole story? How do you feel now?
I've thought about that. I don't know. It was definitely brought so much of it back. One of the interesting things about our brains is that we store away, there's a bit of your brain that stores away everything that at any point in your life it has considered to be life-threatening or potentially life-threatening. And it doesn't store away the context. So if when you were 5 years old, you were chewing a mint and a red car came around the corner and nearly ran you and your mum over, and your mum screamed and ran, and you know, the smell of mints would forever have an effect on you. It's why you get a lot of people who say, oh, I can't stand the smell of hospitals and doctors. And smell bypasses a certain bit of your brain. And for me, what was fascinating going back was the photograph. I took some photographs on that day, and when I went back with you, I stood in the same spot and took photographs again, and I could get that smell into my nostrils at that moment. It was great to see that they had rebuilt lots of things, and there's a fantastic new building, and we went up the top of it and looked down on various things. I just found it, and you know, 2 months later, I'm glad I went. I have no desire to go back again. I've been invited back two or three occasions by one particular company that said I saved a lot of people's lives from their company. In fact, I didn't. They'd have been fine anyway, and they've invited me back, and they want to give me, you know, hero's letters, and I'm not interested in all that. I just think that it wasn't a good day for several thousand people. It wasn't, you know, in one way it was a good day for me. I survived. I was able to do something, and I'm really glad that I found an excuse to go back there, and I did, although I'm not traumatised, but I did put some ghosts to bed, and I have you to thank for that, Amber.
That was my question, actually. Is it final question now? We're quite close to coming to the end.
5 minutes.
That's cool. That kind of closure, you know what I mean? You know, if it's such a thing, I'm not quite sure. I probably couldn't give you £5 to go and buy a bag of closure or a tin of closure, a bit like fear. So, you know, do things like that help with things like closure? Is there such a thing? You just said, like, you know, 2 months later you think back, it was good to go back, but no desire to go again. Do you feel there's a corner turned maybe when it comes to that event?
Yeah, I think so. I think very much a corner turned is the way to look at it. We went back to my apartment block where I lived in Battery Park City, and they wouldn't let me in because I was I wasn't a resident there, you know. And I said, well, I used to live here, and you know, on 9/11, you know, walked in this building and out, and you know, you wouldn't. Sorry, you're not a resident. You can't be here, you know. And it what exemplifies it all for me was about 2 weeks after the whole 9/11 thing. There were people on the street corners selling, you know, cheap laminated pictures of the Twin Towers as they had been. And we come back to an earlier point, the hand of commercialism, you know, it survives absolutely anything. In New York City, they were back there making money pretty quickly after
and,
the
and
whole
that,
thing.
That draws on, you know, kind of roadside talismans and, you know, kind of gifts outside temples and things like that, isn't it? You know, kind of there's a need for us to connect with.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things that kind of struck me a bit earlier was kind of this is told on multiple levels, one of which is symbolic as well as practical, and that kind of deep attachment to, you know, these stories that will... This story is probably one of those defining stories. Once it's rewritten away from the jingoism, will resonate as a kind of a fairy story or a, you know, kind of a mythological story over hundreds or thousands of years, because it kind of impacts on. And I mean my memories of that is watching it online in the office at the university, you know, and I can remember where I was and who was around at the time, and then rushing off home to watch it on TV. So it has that, you know, kind of a uniting global event, which connects people through that kind of mythology.
Trouble is, the terrorists have won, haven't they? You know, I can remember before 9/11, I checked into a flight to come back home at JFK. You just pull up, you chuck your bag at the baggage guys, and it would go off on a trolley, and you'd just tell them what flight you were on, and they'd go, yeah, here's your baggage tag, and you'd walk to the gate. You didn't go through any security. There was a man standing there because it was an international flight asking for your passport. That was the end of the tale. Now there is a multi-billion dollar industry called airport security and
homeland security.
You were going to ask I saw you poised.
Yeah,
ask.
Well, I was just wondering, because I have filmed you and I filmed your experience, how is that for you to watch?
I've only seen it once. Pitiful to see yourself crying on somebody else's movie. But I was what actually got me was people's kindness. I was very, very moved by other people's kindness. You know, the first night I spent in hotel was at the Hilton over at near Newark Airport, and the waiter, you know, I only had my shorts and my running shoes and a t-shirt, and the waiter at breakfast the next morning was quite shy. He just took the rest of his shift off and drove me to a big shopping mall and made them give me clothes and stuff like that, and just people's extraordinary kindness. So in the middle of the madness, there were people who were just really decent and went out of their way to be kind, and I was very moved by that, and still am. And it's my utter shame I can't remember the name of the waiter. I remembered it for years, and I've forgotten it now. It was from somewhere in South America, and he was telling me all about his family. And
do you think that's how we move on beyond an event like that? That we eventually move away from the carefully constructed narrative of, you know, what it is and the buildings and stuff, and the way to really keep it alive is the sort of thing that Amber's done with yourself, you know, and other people in that scenario, which is capture all of these multiple experiences that happened on that day, even the experience of the guy that has done that to give you clothes. And there's many stories like that, isn't there, of people helping people.
Yeah.
Because that's the impact, isn't it? And for me, I think it really is that there's not many days that define changes in the direction of the world. I'm not sure whether nuclear explosions at the end of World War II in Japan had that necessarily amount of experience on a lot of people. Maybe how we then live the next so many decades, it had an experience, but not on people on that day. Whereas that, in real time, to see the world change, I mean, that was quite amazing.
Yeah, it was a game changer in so many different ways, wasn't it? And not for the best. It just made me vow to become an extremist myself. You know, I'd be extremely forgiving and extremely kind and extremely giving and extremely all those good things, because we have to, you know, we have to counter that polarization, don't we? We have to try and lead the way by example of having, you know, exemplary discourse and debate, and be able to disagree with each other and listen to the other person's point of view.
I think the IS bride scenario we find ourselves, the narrative we find ourselves in at the moment, is very polarizing like that, isn't it? And it'd be not now, we don't have the time, but you know, to get your view on that, and as opposed to someone else who's quite, maybe I don't know, quite nationalistic or jingoistic, would bang on about the fact, well, that's it, she's done it, and you might turn around and say, well, actually, you know, there's a child involved and all this sort of stuff. It really makes you, it's not about so much about finding faith in an event like that, because that's always very deeply personal. It's just the fact that, you know, it's that faith in humanity, maybe the faith in the, you know, the good nature of people that then helped you. You know what I mean? It's interesting.
I suppose real change comes from the first people who step back and forgive, rather than those who keep perpetuating the conflict.
Yeah.
And ultimately what we look for, we look at these as markers of, you know, this changes the world. Actually, what changes the world is when people step back from it and go, actually, we're not going to carry on resenting or, you know, kind of hating those people.
And that reminds me of our trip to Cambodia, isn't it? The Chulsling Genocide Museum, and when, you know, Zimphia's book there about both sides of the conflict in Sri Lanka, and, you know, the work that some of our colleagues do at the university around Srebrenica and stuff, you know, those women's, you know, Srebrenica Remembered is about justice, it's not about revenge. And I think, you know, that's really where it comes down, isn't it? There's justice for the people that did it rather than revenge. And it just seems to be a revenge-driven narrative since 9/11, as opposed to an inclusive.
It's funny, you and I were talking about ideas for different documentaries, weren't we? One of the amazing organisations that I've come across is called the Forgiveness Project. And they're based in London. If you Google the Forgiveness Project... And it is the most extraordinary thing, and it's full of tales of forgiveness, and they give talks, and you should get them up to Leicester.
Well, I would look at that. I'll definitely include the link. And if they've got a Twitter account, I'll include that. Well, we've run over the hour, so that's great. And that just, again, as ever, these things just fly by. So that was fantastic. And, John, I have to say, I think maybe even start your own podcast. And, Amber, you're going to have to help John to get his own podcast.
It's funny you should say that, but Amber and I have been working on a podcast for since about last June, July.
Yeah.
But we're getting 12 episodes done before we actually put it out there.
We'll give you some advice about that. We'll give you some advice about that. Well, tweet us when you've got it, because I think they're going to be fascinating to listen to. So,
and thank you for sharing.
This is a Decentered Media podcast. You've been listening to myself, Rob Watson, John Coster, Amber Rundell, and John Hawker. And thank you very much for sharing your stories and experience. It's kind of really, you know, it's kind of very different from the kind of podcast we've done before. So it's just really, you know, kind of good to kind of engage in a different kind of conversation. So as ever, you can find this up on iTunes if you search for Decentered Media, and it's on Twitter at Decentered Media, and the Doc Media Centre is also on Twitter at Doc Media Centre. So hopefully we'll be speaking to you at the same time next week. You've been listening to the Decentered podcast. I'm Rob Watson. If you want to find out more information, contact me on Decentered Media via Twitter or go to decentered.co.uk.